Welcome to the Motorcycle Vagabond Show. Today we have Jeff Westgaard. How you doing, Jeff?
Doing great today.
So, we're interviewing Jeff today. I'm interviewing Jeff today and recording it for everyone to listen to anyways. The only people that really know Jeff tend to be everyone in MMV who thinks he's an asshole. Why do they think you're an asshole, Jeff?
I guess because I have opinions and I like to challenge people to go a little bit outside their comfort zone.
Yeah, it was a couple of rough years with MMV, and I was trying to decide whether we were going to let the trailer people in and how we were going to deal with the fact that everyone wants to argue what their idea of minimalism is.
Well, and, you know, it means something different to everybody, so it's hard to nail it down. You know, some people just see something that's ridiculously small and just say, well, that's minimalist. And I'm like, well, sometimes you can't afford that.
Well, it's kind of sad. The smaller it gets, the more expensive it gets. So not everyone has that kind of budget.
On quite a logarithmic scale.
So what do you ride, Jeff? What bikes do you have?
Right now in the garage, I have got a 2010 Ultra Limited that I think I got about 95,000 miles on it. It was my old go-to bike when I needed one bike that kind of did a lot of things. And then I decided I wanted to go more ADV, so I picked up a 2010 Buell Ulysses cop bike, which is a heck of a good hooligan bike, but it's not that great for ADV. It's geared a little bit high, and it doesn't have any crash protection, and it's got a lot of exposed parts, and can't really get anything to replace them now, since it's a Buell. So then I picked up a Honda CB 500X and put a rally raid kit on it to make it handle a little better, and that's kind of become my go-to bike these days. It's just ridiculously simple and cheap, and you know, I think I got $6,000-$7,000 into a total and gets about 60 miles to the gallon, and it'll take me any place I've ever desired to go. And then I decided I was getting a little cocky on being able to ride whatever I wanted, so I bought a 1949 Panhead, and that one has been quite the learning experience. It's definitely tougher to keep running than I had expected. The engine runs fine, but it's just, you know, it's keeping the bearings happy, it's keeping the gaskets happy, it's keeping, you know, it's, yeah, they're supposed to leak oil, but they're not supposed to leak giant puddles. So it's been a challenge, but it's a joy to ride, so I have no intention of getting rid of it. And then recently I came upon a 1974 Suzuki Water Buffalo, the GT750, which was actually my very first bike, was the same model, slightly different year, and that's my winter project. I want to have that running by spring. Because I really like these old bikes, something that's just a little simpler, a little more throwback, something you just don't see on the road every day. That's what I'm riding.
So let's talk about the old bikes. What's the joy of the old Harley, and how far and where all have you gone on it?
I got it about 6 years ago, and I only have about, I got a little over 8,000 miles on it in those 6 years. The farthest single trip, I was about 250 miles one way. Did a couple nights camping off of it. I like the simplicity. There's no GPS. There's no, you know, heated anything. It's a 6-volt battery. It's kickstart only. It's before they standardize where things are, so your left foot is the clutch, your left hand controls gear shifts, which has got a gear shift on the tank, and it's got your timing control, which you use when you start it to retard the timing to make starting a little easier. And then, you know, it's just got terrible brakes, so you got to maintain about a 3 or 4 second following distance behind somebody, because it doesn't even have hydraulic brakes. It just has, you know, arms that actually, you know, It's got a cable for the front brake, and it's got a series of rods that control the rear drum brake. So I kind of got it expecting it to be something that would be a challenge to ride, but I was really surprised to find out just how much fun it is to ride. It just cruises at 60, 65 down the road, and it just is really happy there.
That sounds like a pretty awesome bike. I love the old bikes as well. I've just never gone that old.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking at the 74 Suzuki as something that's kind of halfway between modern and old. It's still, you know, it's a two cycle, so it's going to, you know, white smoke out the back end is good to a degree. And it makes a lot of noise, but, you know, at the same time, it's something that's pretty reliable on starting. You know, the challenge is modern day bikes, you know, you got 5,000, 8,000 mile service intervals, and the older you get, the more often you're just dealing with bearings and gaskets and clamps, and, you know, it's just, they need a lot more attention just to daily drive them.
Yeah, I know that feeling. Even my 91 DR350, I wrench on it significantly more than I've wrenched on any of my modern bikes. It's just what they need.
But there's something kind of relaxing about knowing that, you know, it's, you know, there's still parts out there. It's not impossible to find parts. And, you know, you can keep them running. And at no time are you relying on some electronics that can't be fixed, possibly.
I have a little bit of conceit and pride in getting to say that I've touched every bolt on this bike. So if something goes wrong, I'm the only one to blame.
That's exactly it.
So I do enjoy getting to say that, even if I am wrenching all of the time. You know, I have to do my fouls every oil change, which is 3,000 miles, and yeah, it develops oil leaks randomly. I got to carry the copper washers that it needs and all the other washers that stop the oil and O-rings. And, you swap it out. It'll be fine. If I don't have an oil leak, I'm pretty impressed.
And I find you kind of, when you're riding on something like that, you're very much riding in the moment. You're very much, you know, listening to what the bike is doing, trying to feel, is there an issue going on? You know, whereas, you know, when I jump on the Ultra Limited, I get bored easily. So, you know, I got to stay off the interstate because that bores me. Or I have to put, you know, tunes on to listen to something to kind of distract me from the monotony. Whereas with these older bikes, you're just constantly focused on the bike. And so you can just enjoy the moment a little bit more than it just being, you know, a reliable, you know, forget what's happening. You know, and then you get surprised when something fails because you weren't paying attention.
Yeah, I agree. Getting to know an older bike and listening to it, you can tell, you're like, oh, it's running a little too fast, or I can tell it's bogging down. I can hear it doing something it's not supposed to do. And you talk to other people and they're like, it's running fine from what I can hear. Yeah, but you don't know it like I do.
Which, you know, that's kind of the joy of something old is you're more connected to it. But, you know, then the trick is to not start hearing things that aren't there.
the paranoia that comes with, oh, what was that?
Yeah, and it's helped me slow down. You know, I'm somebody that, you know, I'm not full-time on the road. I work 60 hours a week most weeks, and then I just have 2 or 3 weeks a year that I get out and I go hard. And I tend to push myself too hard. So I need some kind of an excuse just to slow down a bit. So when I'm riding on an older bike, I'm not pushing it in the middle of the night as hard or, you know, and then I've been taking a lot more photos lately, which is just slowing me down, just saying, hey, let's slow down. Let's enjoy this. Let's spend fewer miles and shoot for a few more smiles if that's the goal.
That's why I like about my 350. A lot of people are, you could be on a modern bike and go further and faster. And I'm like, why? I get the luxury of doing this a lot because this is my lifestyle. the slower bike makes sure that I do take my time. I stop more often to let the bike cool off because it is air-cooled and check the oil because, well, it eats oil. And, you know, do all the other things that is oddly enjoyable to have the schedule with the bike. So let's talk about your modern bikes. What have you done with your Harley? Because I think you said you've done some long-distance things.
Basically, you know, every bike I have has a stock seat on it. I've never actually gotten around to changing the seat. To me, it seems like a little bit of a waste of money. And then I also don't touch the engines. Everything I have is however I got it. I think my Ultra Limited might have a slightly different intake system than stock, but I bought it secondhand to, you know, get it a little cheaper. And I think the guy before me did something, but I'm not even sure what that is. The modifications I've made are simply putting a little bit better light system on.
Well, that's not so bad. So you've done the Hokkaido, right? Was it on that bike?
I did 90% of the 2011 Hokkaido. I was 10,000 miles into it when the pickup decided he wanted to occupy my lane, and I plowed into him doing about 60 miles an hour, and that ended that run.
How was the experience doing the Hokkaido? And what is the Hokkaido for those who don't know?
The Hokkaido was a run that started in 2010. It was open to American-made motorcycles. It was a little bit kind of a roots run that was kind of set up kind of in opposition to some of the more the iron butt run where you're using computers and technology to help plan your route. This was a run that was designed just to follow a map and try to stay on course and test what your limits are as far as how much you can do in a day. And hopefully you're making wise decisions as to when to stop because, you know, in essence, it's just, you know, the year I did it was 14,000 miles. You start one day and there's no reason to stop until you get to the end. And so it's finding that 90 minutes or 2 hours every day to rest, recharge, and start up the next day. And I don't think it's a perfect event. I haven't had any urgings to do it again, but I will say it was the 10 days that are the most seared in my brain is just being amazing riding, amazing test of what I can do when I'm on the road on a bike as far as, you know, how hard can I push myself and still be functioning in a reasonably safe manner. Does that kind of explain it?
It does explain it. A lot of people don't understand what there is to doing 1,000 miles a day for multiple days in a row. Because as you know, people are like, that doesn't seem like it'd be fun. It would be painful. And so getting the chance to actually talk about the joys of doing it. And some people really enjoy getting to test their limits. And that is kind of the event that you can do such a thing with.
Yeah, you're just kind of laying it all out there. And you're just kind of seeing, you know, and the advantage of the route is they pick some of the most beautiful places in the U.S. to ride. It was all two lane. There was no interstate involved. And so, you know, it's not a race, but you're kind of racing to the best of your ability. But you're doing it on a course that involved, you know, Pacific Coast Highway, Beartooth Pass, Death Valley. And, well, that was Millie afternoon, so that wasn't exactly enjoyable, but it was memorable. And so, you know, it's a case of Lolo Pass. I remember waking up at the base of Lolo Pass and riding Lolo Pass as the dawn was breaking. There was just moments that just kind of seared themselves in your brain, and that I've done many other events and whatnot. Nothing seared itself in my brain, just like some of the moments on those 10 days.
I'm not sure I'd have it in me to be able to do that kind of ride, even if I had a bike to do it on. So what about the cannonballs? I think you've done a few of those as well.
I follow the Cannonball. I got friends that have done the motorcycle Cannonball. A somewhat buddy of mine, Dave Currier, won it this last year in his 1911. I just think that, you know, jumping on a modern bike and doing 10,000 miles in a day is impressive. It's fun. It's a real challenge. But jumping on a bike that's, you know, 110 years old, that has a top speed of about 40 miles an hour, doesn't have any gears, all you have is a lever to engage the motor or disengage the motor, I think that's just next level, you know, challenge to, you know, keep something like that running for, I think the total distance is around 5,000 miles. Is just crazy.
You think you'll ever put your old Harley in there?
I would like to do a run like that, but I don't know that I would do something that's competitive. I think I've got in my mind a dream run of recreating the Parks to Park route of 1925, where they figured out a way to get to all 12 national parks at the time. That's about 4,000 miles. I think that's something that's more up my line of a personal challenge on that old bike than doing it in a group where, well, frankly, I'm probably in the wrong tax bracket because I just don't have the support to do it by myself.
That'd be a really cool ride, though, recreating a 1925 ride. I mean, it'd be even cooler if you did it in 2025.
Yeah. The first time they did it was, I think, in 1921 or 22, and I missed that opportunity, but...
Just by a few years, right?
Well, I just wasn't ready. They ran it in, 1921 or 22, and I was going to try and do it in 2021 or 2022, and my planning didn't work out.
So, I've seen you packed up on a bike. You've come to a couple of my events. And it's really impressive that a big man like you on the Honda CB500X with such little gear can still be comfortable enough to travel. And tell me what you carry on this bike for multiple days of riding.
Basically, I carry just my base gear, which is my one-person Big Agnes tent. I've got an old Marmot sleeping bag. It's 2 pounds. I got a Therm-a-Rest. I got a little inflatable pillow. That's my base gear. And then for every trip, I just kind of decide, what do I need on top of that? What do I need to bring for spare clothes? What do I need to bring for camera gear? And it's not much more than those four items usually. So I've just found that, you know, it's part of the joy in me is projecting what might I need and trying to only have those items.
Have you ever found that you weren't prepared for a situation because you carry so little?
On occasion, I've been uncomfortable, but I've never felt like I was in trouble. I know, like this last trip I did, I was in the Colorado Mountains in early October, and I read the map wrong. I thought I was at like 6,000 or 7,000 feet, and I spent one night a little over 9,000 feet. That night got cold in October, and my 32 degree rated bag that I purchased 20 some years ago probably isn't still rated at 32 degrees, and so that was a chilly night.
Well, I mean, even when they say they're rated at 32 degrees, that's like survivable 32. It's usually comfortable to 10 to 20 over that.
Yeah, well, it's a really comfortable bag at 40.
Which is pretty impressive for its age.
Yeah, it's holding up.
Well, that's not all so bad then. Where all have you been on the Honda?
Let's see. Everywhere in the U.S. and Canada except Hawaii and Nunavut. I try to find just different corners. Some of my favorite places tend to be at the very extremes. I found Newfoundland to be an amazing place to ride. Parks like Gros Morne were great, but just stopping for coffee, meeting the people there. You know, I've never been any place where people are just so friendly and just want to talk to everybody. I don't know if they don't get to talk to many people out there or what the reason is, but they're great. But I love there. I loved Northwest Territories and Alaska are the places that when I'm dreaming of where to go, it's usually in the first places I think of. One of the next places I want to get back to is Baja California, simply for tacos. And beach and warm weather in the winter. But I try to pick different places to make sure I've had an opportunity to go everywhere, at least once.
How was that trip up to Inuvik? And for those who don't know, that's the Tuktoyaktuk Highway, I believe, that opened up a few years ago.
Yeah, that's the extension on the Dempster, where the Dempster starts near Dawson City in Yukon, and then it heads up to Inuvik, which I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing close to right. But then in 2018, they added a spur highway of about another 100 miles that goes to the town of Tuktoyaktuk, which has never had a road go to it before. It's right on the Arctic Ocean. It's the only place in North America I think you can ride to. And then without paying for a tour or doing a tour, you can just jump in the ocean from that point. So I did that midnight. Sun was still out. It was kind of fun. But it's just a little community. The people were very friendly. They were very new to having visitors at that point. And so it's a native community. And so I was introduced to a few of the elders. People invited me over to have cookies. It was a really special time.
How long did you stay up there?
I planned to be there for a few hours and turn around. But when I got there, it was raining and the roads were impassable. I ended up spending a couple days up there. But the Dempster Highway is kind of a special road. It's about 500 miles of gravel, and there's kind of one gas stop in the middle of it.
That's one of those big markers that a lot of travelers go for, the Dempster, and going to, that big sign up on the oil road in Alaska.
Yep, Prudhoe Bay.
Yeah. So what did you eat while you were up in the little village?
I had some, we stopped at, I stopped first at the campground in town, which is a little free campground right on the ocean, and it was raining, and one of the locals comes up and says, "Don't even bother setting your tent up. I have a cabin. Come over, spend the night in my cabin." Got to his cabin. It was already occupied, but that made it kind of fun. There was two hitchhikers from Germany that were there. I have no idea still how they got up there. So it was another motorcyclist I met up there, myself, the two German hitchhikers, hanging out in this little cabin that was kind of a hunting cabin that he hadn't drug out to the hunting areas yet. And we spent 2 days there, and he fed us some of his food for free. I think we had eggs. We had a spam-like concoction. I forget, Click, I think it's called. Fried potatoes. One of the neighbors brought over some smoked fish. That's a pretty common meal up there. I did have a small sample of muktuk, which is whale.
How was that?
It wasn't good.
It was an experience?
It was an experience, and unfortunately at the time, they were just starting to plan their whale hunt for the year, and so it was kind of year-old whale, which I don't think is maybe as good as fresh whale might be. So it was definitely an experience and not something that was enjoyable. But the rest of the food was good, and then most of the rest of that trip, I remember I brought some homemade meals that I made that just had to add water to make them.
So AJ spent a good part of his growing up in Alaska, and he's had fresh whale, and he says it still doesn't taste good even when it's fresh.
It's my thoughts of it was like fishy tasting grizzle.
I mean, I'd eat it. I'm not saying I like it, but I'd eat it.
I think I could sustain myself on it, but yeah, it's not enjoyable to me.
Yeah, that's a ride that not a lot of people have done yet.
Well, they, you know, they opened up in 2018, and then basically they were shut down for a couple years. And so now people, I think there was quite a flood of people up there this last year, and I expect next year there'll be even a bigger flood of people. And so I don't know if I would go up there next year because I think they might be a little overwhelmed with a semi-gold rush of people that have been pent up at the borders and stuff.
Yeah, I'd like to get up there as well, but I really hope that the travelers who are getting up there are setting a good example for, you know, foreigners and travelers, but I've heard enough stories to know that not all of them are trying to give an example of us.
That's definitely true with anyone that rides a motorcycle. There's some amazing people, and there's some people you're like, just go away.
I ride to not hang out with you, but I'll ride to hang out with this other person who's really cool. So you've been to all 48 lower states. What are some of your favorite places you've been?
Some of the hidden, well, okay, maybe they're not hidden gems, but they were new to me is Utah has always blown me away. I will treat Utah as a destination state any day of the week. It's just, it's got such a variety from forests to red rocks to salt lakes to whatever. Arkansas surprised me. I found it to be a very laid-back, enjoyable place to ride. But mostly mountains draw me. Colorado, it's spectacular. I've always enjoyed any place I've been in California as far as the riding. I didn't think where else. But, you know, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, just that whole mountain band is just spectacular.
I like to call Arkansas the most underrated place in the country, and shh, don't tell everyone. So what kind of riding do you like to do? Are you an on-road, off-road, trail? What kind of trails kind of rider?
If I got my choice, I would spend all of my riding on either poorly maintained small paved roads or pretty decent maintained gravel roads. I try my best to avoid interstates. I'm a truck driver by trade, so I've spent millions of miles on the interstate, and so when I'm trying to enjoy myself, I try to get off the interstate. But I'm fully aware that my capabilities could be pushed as soon as I get off of a decent gravel road.
Have you done any of the well-known, like, BDRs or TAT or the Transcontinental Trail or anything like that?
I've done sections. I've done about 300 miles of the Washington BDR. I've done a few sections of the TAT. I know Geyser Pass has been on that. I've done that a few times. That's in Utah. I've also done, Apir Pass recently, which I think that's been on the trail a few times, and that was a blast. It was amazing, and I think it was at the close to the upper limits of my capabilities.
Would you do it again, knowing that it was a challenge?
Yeah, yeah. One of these years, I'd like to try Black Bear Pass, and I don't know if that would be fun or if that would just be scary.
Could be both.
I got to do it up here going up it. I've gone down it and that was entertaining. I kind of found that with that CB500X running street tires, that the perfect speed was running down it with the kill switch on. So I was running in first gear, engine off, for that was the proper amount of braking, so I didn't have to hardly stand the brakes at all.
Yeah, doing a ride like that, you'd heat up your brakes real quick if you had to ride them.
Yeah, especially since I'm a little chubby.
Aren't you like 6'4"?
No, I'm 6 foot even.
Oh, okay.
250.
And the CB500X is like a 470-pound bike?
Loaded up, I've gone over scales at 440.
Oh, man. That's really not bad. Sometimes I miss my Honda. I had 2013. Always made me angry that I couldn't get more miles than you in a year, even though you work
48 weeks a year.
Yeah. It's embarrassing. So what kind of rides do you have planned for the future?
Well, I don't have any real rides planned at this point. Right now I'm working on getting that Suzuki GT750 running. And then once I get that running, I want to do something kind of big with that. And I also want to get the Panhead ship shape, because I feel the next 2 summers are probably my best chance of getting that park-to-park run going. And so that's kind of my next big goal is, once I figure out the year I do that, then everything else is going to kind of go to the back burner. But other than that, I'll just take a week here and there and see what looks like an interesting destination for that week.
Those are going to be exciting rides. Are you going to, post them up online and let people follow you or anything?
I usually do that. I my favorite thing to do is to try to come up with good pictures so I can post 4 pictures per day. That kind of causes me to edit myself, where I got to find 4 pictures that represent everything that was good in that day. And then I just post them to my own personal page. I'm fully aware that I'm not interesting enough to try and gather followers.
I think you're interesting enough to gather followers. You just don't put the effort in for it.
Oh, I am lazy.
Well, I mean, that's the human nature, isn't it?
I'm maybe lazier than most. Especially at hitting deadlines.
I think that'll be a really awesome ride. So tell me about the Honda Off-Road. I know a lot of people don't know much about that bike. How does it handle, and does the Rally Raid kit make a big difference?
I don't think the Rally Raid kit makes a huge difference. I put it on when I had like 400 miles on the bike, so I don't remember that much how it was without the kit. It adds about 2 more inches of suspension travel, and it's just a slightly better suspension system. But I don't really think it makes the bike much more capable. It just makes it a little more comfortable. And I don't think it's a great bike off-road. I think it's fully in the dual sport category. It's not, or in the ADV category, where it's a road bike that's somewhat capable off pavement. It's not a dirt bike that can also do roads. But I think it does gravel better than most of them, because it's 440 pounds, and so it's just a little less tippy when you make a mistake than the 500 to 600 pound ADV bikes.
Yeah, the ones that have huge tanks that bring the center of gravity up.
Correct.
And you know, it's a great idea to carry 10 gallons of gas until you have to, handle 10 gallons of gas on the bike.
Yeah, the Honda I have carries 4.6 gallons, so if you have an extra 5 gallons, that's 30 pounds at waist level, which isn't exactly the best place to carry it when you hit a rock that lurches you to the side, and now you have to try and recover from that 30 pounds in a not great position.
You think about doing any New Mexico on it?
I'd like to do more in Mexico. It's a long ways from North Dakota. And so it's just finding the time, because it's basically a week almost to get down there and to get back. So then it's,
You're like in a really great place, but a really horrible place. You're in the middle of the country, but it takes you forever to get anywhere interesting.
Correct. It's 1,000 miles to get to any place fun.
Whether that be Colorado or Montana or going to the Appalachians. Appalachians?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure you've ridden just about every road in North Dakota at this point.
If I haven't ridden them, I've driven them.
Do you have a favorite?
I do have a few I like. Way over by Montana, there's a Highway 16 that is in the middle of nowhere. I guarantee you'll see 100 cows for every person you see. And it's just kind of a nice twisty road in the middle of nowhere.
Any others or just the one?
Just pretty much that one. That's an interesting motorcycle road. Now, I've found over the years that I actually enjoy... We do have a road not too far from my house, which is North Dakota Highway 46, which we've nicknamed the Taint of the Dragon, because at one time I think it was the third or fourth straightest road in the nation. I think it's 140 miles with two slight swerves, but over the years a couple of ponds have grown in size and they've veered it a little bit, so they've added some curves, but it's still pretty straight, and it's kind of nice just to go straight sometimes and just think about the ride and not necessarily be technical.
Yeah, those straight roads do have a value that you can do a lot more in your head and not need as much attention on the road. Not to say that distracted riding is a great thing, but, you know, it's a lot of us are on there to almost meditate, and the straight roads give you more chance to do so.
Yeah, it's not Highway 50 straight road meditate, zero traffic, but it's close.
You know, I just rode Highway 50 all the way through Nevada. I picked it up in Utah. I did some of it in Utah, and I rode it all the way to California. And it's not actually that straight, and it's really not that boring, and it's not as desolate as some people think. I've done some other roads in Nevada where you see even less traffic. It's actually a pretty fun road, and you go over at least a dozen passes.
Oh, it's been about 10, 12 years since I've done it, but it's a fun road, but it's you're by yourself, kind of.
You got to do it again, but it's built up quite a bit more.
Okay.
Like, the towns have gotten bigger, and they've built some new stuff, and because it's the loneliest road in America, everyone wants to go ride it, so it's kind of not as lonely as it used to be.
Sure.
But I still really liked it. Like Ely, and there's a couple other towns that have some traffic, but between about the middle of the state to California is pretty dead. But there's a lot of great history. I don't know if you ever stopped, but there's a lot of great history about the Pony Express and the post, all the post stuff and some train track stuff. It's pretty good stops.
Okay. I left it in a long distance rally, so it was kind of in the middle of the night. I don't really remember a whole lot other than it was stuff. Didn't meet a lot of cars at that point.
Yeah. So do you have any advice for anyone who wants to learn how to be a minimalist packer? And I say this specifically as a minimalist packer because a lot of people think that, or a lot of people's opinions of minimalist can also be just a credit card, no gear. I mean, of course you don't have to have a weighted down bike if you have the money to, you know, buy a room every night. But for those of us who can but need to save the money, do you have any tips for reducing gear?
I think the biggest thing is to figure out what your comfort level is as far as the what ifs. I think a lot of people get bogged down that they sit there before they go on a trip and they go, well, what if this happens? I have to have something to cover for that. And so they add something. And, or my joke is I never go to a store before I do a long trip because they'll have thousands of solutions to problems I really didn't have. And so it's a lot of it is in your head and just eliminating those what if items and saying, truly, what do I need to feel comfortable? You know, what, you know, there are things that you'll probably never use that you do need to bring. You do need some first aid items. And then any one I think responsible, especially the farther out you get, you do have to have some tools. You don't necessarily need the tools to rebuild your bike, but you need enough tools that you can get back to civilization, hopefully. Because, getting stuck in the wilderness is going to be an expensive tow if you can't at least limp back to a highway. And so I don't think there's specific gear. You just have to say, what basics do I have to have? And then, building the confidence in your own abilities to say that if I don't have something I need, I can either get it, find it, or do without.
I think, as you just said, and what I've always said as well, is it's a mentality more than it is anything else. If you can't get your mind wrapped around it, you'll never be able to reduce your gear.
And
that's the biggest struggle.
Yeah, and it's kind of figuring out, sometimes, like a lot of people will say, I need a tent that I can stand up in. And to me, I try to use a tent so little that I'm going into my tent once, out of my tent once each day. And so if I have to do that on my knees, it's maybe not comfortable, but it's one time a day where if I can save 5 pounds and half a saddlebag's worth of room to do that with a small tent, to me, I'm ahead of the game if I'm carrying something lighter during the day where I've got that on the back of my bike for 10 hours that day. Well, if I can save some weight there, that's more important than that one time in, one time out. I never carry a chair because, I figure I can find something to sit. So sometimes, when I'm bringing food with, I'll stop at a rest area and I'll cook dinner because they have tables, they have chairs, they have everything like that. And then I'll move a couple hours down the road before I set up camp, but I don't need to sit at that point. At that point, I'm just sleeping. Or I'll find a rock. Or I think I was at one vagabond gathering, and I found this really nice log that was near the campfire, and I sat on it. The disappointing thing was, every time I left, they'd hack another chunk of the log off, and so my chair kept getting worse and worse because they were chopping the thick end of the log off, and I thought it was rather rude to, if I was to demand that was my only, my chair, but it worked.
you may should have found it like a rock.
And not having a chair, I've had lunch sitting in the seat of my bike, set lunch on my tank bag because I didn't find a better option. The ground was wet or whatever. So it's to me, that's a reasonable sacrifice not to have to deal with a chair that I realize some of them aren't very big, but I'm kind of big, so I don't really trust them.
Yeah. When it comes to your size, you'd have to get a higher end chair, which then takes up more weight and more space.
And I have mentioned I'm rather lazy, but I'm also rather cheap.
So. Yeah, the smaller the chair, the more expensive it gets. The Kelenox Zero chair, which is like 1 pound on the size of a 1 liter bottle, they're like $120.
So, yeah, no, when I'm traveling, I shouldn't say never, but maybe once every 2 or 3 years, I'll spend a night in a hotel, but the rest of the time, I'm going to be camping. I love the idea of Monk a Biker, but I don't plan ahead far enough to make that work into my travels. So I'm just camping every night. And some nights I'm in a really nice free campground, and other nights I'm just side of the road making it work.
How important is the camping for your traveling? What's the biggest joy of your day? Is it the riding, the camping, equally both? Or is camping just a means to an end to get some sleep?
Most of my travels, camping is just getting rest. But I do, you know, when I've been on the different rallies, you know, when there is a night, when they have a bonfire, whatever, those are some of my favorite nights. But I don't need a campfire, you know, more than when it's a social event. I would certainly never build a fire just to enjoy the night by myself.
I wouldn't either. A lot of people, I guess, assume I would make a fire every night, and I laugh and say, well, I'm lazy. The only time I want a fire is that if I'm socializing with people, like I'm camping around people, or I'm specifically going to cook something on it, which is very rare for me.
Probably my favorite parts of the trips are when you just poke your head up over a vista and you're like, okay, that's crazy incredible. That's amazing. You know, and sometimes I try to capture a picture of it to show how stunning it is, but I know that a picture will never do it justice. All I'm doing is saying, you know, I'm maybe taking a picture that might tease somebody into trying to recreate that same thing, but it's those, you know, jaw-dropping vistas that are maybe my favorite part.
So if you were to say, you know how they say that there's ride to eat, ride to ride, ride to photograph, would you be a ride to see new things?
Yeah, probably ride to experience new things. Because sometimes it's, you know, I know the last ride, one of the actual goals, I had about three goals on that ride, and one of them was to give the Canyonlands switchbacks on the Schaefer Trail a shot. And so, you know, by the time I got to the top of the switchbacks, that was an incredible event to me because I'd kind of been planning that for a couple of years.
I'm sure you get quite a bit of time in the truck daydreaming about the next place you want to ride to.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I'm disappointed that, you know, Facebook keeps throwing more and more algorithms at us, but to me that was kind of in the heyday of Facebook, which I thought was maybe, you know, 5 to 10 years ago, there was a bunch of groups, and I just loved going through the different people and seeing what they found out there that maybe I wasn't aware of, and then saying, okay, that's going on the list of places I got to try and get to.
Yeah, it's gotten kind of hard, and you know, I'm in all those groups too, and we have struggles with the algorithm issues with MMV. We've been deprioritized, and they don't fix it. But even being in the other Facebook groups, MC and LDR and all that, I just don't see a lot of the posts I used to enjoy. I wanted to see, like, this is where I went. These are where my pictures are from. And, you know, they can share their experience, but I'm here to see the picture and the location so I can slap it onto my map and go check it out for myself. And I just don't see a lot of those posts as much anymore.
Yeah, it seems like it's going more towards, you know, the computer-generated suggestions of what I might like, which I probably won't, or it's gone to a lot more professionals that are trying to plug their videos, which I don't know if I don't have the energy to watch videos usually. I just want to see a couple pictures where I'm like, okay, that looks cool.
Oh, make a group that's just called Ride Reports.
Hmm.
Pictures and minimum of three sentences. Go.
Well, I think I mentioned earlier, you know, that's why I like, you know, condensing my days down to four pictures where I'm not, you know, I'm not saying, well, here's 89 pictures that I took today. You know, I like to just say, here's four. These are the four that mean something to me. These are the four that I think share the experience I had today. And I'll, you know, I'll write down where each one was taken, but it's, you know, I think data is too cheap these days. People like to dump too much stuff on there. There's too few people that throw up videos that are good at editing down their content to something that's enjoyable.
I do the same thing. I like to put five unless I specifically go somewhere that required a lot more. But five, because that's, you don't get the plus to where you can see the next ones. So the five pictures and just a short story that people will either laugh at or inspire them to maybe go out and see the thing I just saw.
Yeah, I just realized your adventure snippets were based on 4 pictures, weren't they?
I think so. 4 or 5.
Yeah.
2 to 5, maybe?
Maybe you're the one that shaped me into doing that.
Did I condition you and I didn't even realize it? Well, hopefully one day we can either I'll start a new group or someone will start a group and get these things to happen, but I just don't feel like people want to put the effort into taking the pictures and sharing their stories. It's always, what tent do I need, or where should I ride this year? What color should I paint my bike? I just stare at them like, I don't think you should be asking the internet for answers to most of that stuff, but all right.
Well, and I'd encourage more people that when they do something and they're like, okay, that floored me, that was enjoyable, post them up there. It doesn't have to be great pictures. You know, I think too many people see the semi-professionals that are out there and they get intimidated. But some of us just want to see places that just spark that interest in our own mind and say, hey, thanks for finding that spot. Where is it? I want to check it out.
Oh, absolutely. I have the same issue with people don't want to tell me about their adventures because I've done, you know, quote unquote, I've done more than them. And I'm like, it's not a comparison game. Just because I do it more often doesn't mean I've been to the places you've been. And I like to hear your stories. I like to see that enthusiasm with other people who are doing the thing that I also like doing. So just because I'm a professional or there are other professionals that may, you know, quote unquote, do it better than you, doesn't mean that we don't want to see it. And that other people don't want to see it.
And, you know, as I mentioned, it's a spark. Sometimes you don't need details. You just need that one thing to say, okay, I haven't seen that before. Now that's on my list. Tell me a little bit.
Right. So how many miles do you usually get in a year? Ride in a year?
I'm usually between 20 and 32,000 in a given year.
And what's your ride season?
Has been done. My last trip is usually early October, and my first trip is usually the end of April. Between those two times, I always have at least one bike that's not winterized, that if there's a break in the weather, I'll go for a spin. So I don't actually winterize everything, but it's about 6 months.
Yeah, as I said, that's 5 or 6 months, and you're getting some pretty good mileage in there. You often get off on your last day of the week and get out and ride until you have to turn around and make it back Monday morning, don't you?
I try to do that about 5 or 6 times a year.
It's pretty impressive. I've seen some of your weekend jaunts, and you get pretty far.
Yeah, it's about 1,000-mile radius is about my weekend jaunt.
Good.
Which allows me to I can just snake into Beartooth Pass, which is definitely one of my favorites. I try to do that just about every year.
That's one of my favorites, too. I found that road when I first hit the road in 2016, and I've made sure to take every bike I have on it. I've had. It's a very special road.
It is.
Is there anything else you'd like to share, Jeff? Anything that you think would be inspiring for the listeners who have not gone out and done the things yet? And I mean, in no offensive manner, you're a normal guy with a job that goes out and still does incredible things on his bike, and I hope people find that inspiring like I do. People often don't find me relatable because I'm living the life. It's been years I've been doing this, but someone like you who's still doing it anyways, I find that to be amazing.
Well, I think, you know, the thing I've learned, and I guess my message that I've learned from the long-distance riding, and I wouldn't recommend long-distance riding competitions for a lot of people. It's a pretty small group of a small group that actually gets enjoyment out of that. But I found it shrunk the world. Now, I'm still can't cross an ocean worth of crap, but, you know, having that long distance underneath my belt, I'm fully aware that anywhere in North America, it's just a few days to get there if you really want to. And so the ability to shrink the world is something I think is kind of magical about motorcycles. And so I just encourage people to get out there, give it a try. It's as difficult as you want to make it. There are people that just grab their stuff and go, and they make it work. And there's other people that, no matter how much planning, it seems like the first day into a trip, they have a problem and they head back. But I think, you know, if you go in with an open mind, it's amazing what a bike can do. A few weeks ago, I went out and I think I went just over 4,000 miles. I went through 71 gallons of gas. I spent zero money on hotels or camping. I think I kept it around $40 a day for food, but I ate well and even managed to get smashed one night. And I think it's just it's the most approachable way to get out there and see the world on an efficient, timely manner. Because I guess you could ride bicycle or you could walk and it's cheaper, but I don't have the time for that.
Well, it may be cheaper. A bicycle or walking may be cheaper than potentially the motorcycle, but you spend more time doing it, so you end up eating more food. And, I mean, even bicycles still have maintenance and parts that they require.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that it's really cheaper. It takes you longer, so you have to feed yourself more days. And you're also wearing your gear out, too.
Yeah, that's what I was just saying. I think it's the most economical way of getting out there and exploring what's around us and just, you know, seeing a place and saying, that looks interesting. If you got a motorcycle, it doesn't take much to go and see that, no matter where that is. If that's, you know, 100 miles away, if it's 2,000 miles away.
Right. I agree. It's make your plan and head for it. You ride a motorcycle, you're part of a community. You can probably find help if something happens. There's lots of dealers, lots of parts, lots of resources online if you really want to do all those things. But, yeah, just go do it.
So, no, I just want to say thanks for what you do, bringing a community together. It's not easy to bring this community together in any fashion and keep us a bit on point from time to time and just get people that kind of get it kind of in the same room.
Thank you. I really enjoy doing it and getting to run MMV for these, well, Minimalist Motorcycle Vagabonds and Campers now for the last, man, it's going to be 6 years soon. In February, it'll be 6 years. It's been a blast getting to find all the lone cats that don't want to really do it with anyone but want to find other people to share it with online, and then getting a chance to bring some of them together in person. I'm sad that it's been such a struggle with Facebook to keep the group active, but I'm kind of considering doing the revamp still. You and I have talked about this, but we'll see what happens, I guess. Facebook makes it kind of hard to make it happen, but it's still been a great run, and I'm still enjoying the group even as it is.
Yeah, definitely me too.
So thank you for chatting with me, Jeff. Anything else you'd like to say before we end it?
No, I'm good.
Well, thank you very much. Send me a couple pictures.
Okay. I owe you a couple pictures. I know I promised you a few already, so I'll get on those.
I appreciate it. I'll put your name on the book.
Okay.
Have a good one.
You too. Thanks. Bye.
All right, bye.